On the Sunday morning, this is the already the third morning of the retreat. It goes very quickly. And this time of the retreat, I wanted to talk about the obstacles to meditation. So I'm sure you've encountered many by now. And it's important to know exactly what they are and what to do with them, how to overcome them. And because one can waste a lot of time if one firstly doesn't recognize what the problem is, and secondly one doesn't take the proper remedial action. To remember that this path of meditation is a very well-worn path. 25 centuries at least of experience and investigation, research if you like, has gone into the way to calm the mind, to liberate the mind, to make the mind peaceful. So because of all of that experience, there are some very beautiful methods of overcoming those obstacles to free the path so you can experience the very beautiful and peaceful states of mind. The best description of those obstacles was given by the Buddha himself, and it's called the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana. And I wanted to talk about those five hindrances this morning. But first of all, I wanted to mention the importance of overcoming those five hindrances. I mentioned this briefly in a talk the other night from one of the suttas, and I just want to read out this passage from the Nalakapana Sutta on what the purpose of these five hindrances are, or rather of overcoming them and their place within the practice of jhana. This is from the Nalakapana Sutta, the 68th sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, and this was given by the Buddha to Venerable Anuruddha, who was a great meditator. He was one of the cousins of the Buddha. And on that occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, asked the monks, "Monks, those who have gone forth out of faith, from the home life into homelessness under me, do they delight in the holy life?" When this was said, the monks were silent. And the second or third time, "Do the monks delight in the holy life?" And no one answered, so the Buddha asked Venerable Anuruddha, "Anuruddha, do you all delight in the holy life?" "Surely, Venerable Sir, we delight in the holy life." "Good, good, Anuruddha. It is proper for all you monks who have gone forth out of faith and the home life into homelessness to delight in the holy life. As you are still endowed with the blessing of youth, black-haired young men in the prime of life, you could have indulged in sensual pleasures. Yet instead you have gone forth from the home life into homelessness. It is not because you have been driven by kings, or because you have been driven by thieves, or owing to debt, fear, or just want of a livelihood. Rather, you have gone forth into the monastic life thinking, 'I am a victim of birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known.' Now what should be done, Anuruddha, by someone who has gone forth thus?" And this is the important point. "While they still do not attain to that rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or they don't attain to something more peaceful than that, covetousness invades his mind and remains. Ill will invades their mind and remains. Sloth and torpor invade their mind and remain. Restlessness and remorse invade their mind and remain. Doubt invades their mind and remain. Discontent invades their mind and remain. And weariness invades their mind and remains. So, that is so, while they still do not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that. But when one does attain to the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures, that are secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, then covetousness does not invade the mind and remain. Ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, discontent, weariness, do not invade the mind and remain. That is so when one attains the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasures and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that." And those of you who have some familiarity with the Buddha's teachings will have recognized that the the pleasure which is secluded, the happiness which is, what do I say over here? The rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sexual pleasures, that are secluded from unwholesome states, refers to the jhanas, especially the first jhana. So what the Buddha is saying here, that if you haven't attained to those jhanas, then these things, such as covetousness, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt, together with weariness and discontent, they invade the mind and remain. And you will recognize those as the five hindrances plus two extra, discontent and weariness. What is actually saying again is that one has to overcome these hindrances to enter the jhanas, but by overcoming them for a short time, after the jhanas have been achieved, then these five hindrances are eradicated for long periods of time. This is the way the Buddha said that the five hindrances are eradicated, do not invade the mind and remain through the practice of this deep meditation. If you don't attain to those pleasures, the five hindrances do invade the mind and remain. The deep meditations are the difference between clarity caused by the abandonment of the five hindrances and the lack of clarity, the mistiness of the mind when these five hindrances are still there. And so you might say that the whole point of this practice, if you wish to get enlightened, is to abandon the five hindrances so you can see clearly. So you can do, as I was saying yesterday, you can do the Satipatthana meditation. But if you haven't developed the peaceful states of mind, the jhanas, then those five hindrances will still be lingering there and you will not be able to see clearly. So our job should be to notice those five hindrances, know what they are, abandon them temporarily enough to get into these powerful states of mind, and that knocks them out for great lengths of time, giving you the window of opportunity, as they say, to see the Dhamma, to see the truth. But that shows you the importance of the five hindrances and how jhana meditation fits in with the eradication of those five hindrances. But now to come to the important part of this morning's talk, those five hindrances I've already mentioned in this passage from the Buddha's teachings. There are called here covetousness, number one, ill will, number two, sloth and torpor, number three, restlessness and remorse, number four, and doubt, number five. You may have noticed here that this is again one of the suttas which uses the word covetousness, abhijja, as the first hindrance. And I just bring your attention to that because that's the same word used in the Satipatthana, having overcome that covetousness. The word covetousness is not a very good translation because the other synonym for the first hindrance, the more common term for the first hindrance, is kamachanda. That first hindrance is the interest in comfort through the five senses. I like to use the word comfort through the five senses rather than sensory pleasure because it also includes just the minor seeking for pleasure in the world of the five senses. Even like scratching the hair is kamachanda. It's seeking for comfort in any of these five sense world. The second of the hindrances is always ill will. The third of the hindrances is restlessness and remorse. It's much better translation than the usual restlessness and worry. I'll explain why in a moment. And then there is the fifth hindrance of doubt. To understand what these hindrances are, the Buddha gave some very beautiful similes. First of all, the simile which he gave for the first hindrance of sensory desire, he said it's like being in debt. And this is a very powerful simile because it elucidates the fact that if you seek for sensory pleasure and you find that sensory comfort or pleasure, you have to pay for it afterwards. You have to pay for it because every pleasure which you get will be followed by the fading away of that pleasure and the longing for what is now gone. It's a sense of you're just borrowing energy, you're just borrowing happiness. And the more you borrow, the more you have to pay back afterwards. If you go to the most expensive restaurant and eat this delicious food, then you've got to pay for it afterwards because the food your wife cooks is nowhere near as good. If you go and see a marvelous movie somewhere, then you have to pay for it afterwards because everything else just pales in insignificance afterwards. Whatever pleasure you sort of try and seek for in the world is like that. It leaves you feeling empty, in debt, after the pleasure has disappeared. And this is even with physical comfort. Sometimes in the meditation, this particular hindrance can be very subtle. It's not just looking for great pleasures in the world. It's not just looking for sex, looking for stimulation, looking for nice food, looking for pleasurable things to see. That five sense pleasures, even if just scratching your nose when it's itchy, which I just did. And you know, when you're meditating, it's just so hard to get comfort in this body. In fact, how long can you sit there on your meditation stool or cushion without moving? Can you find a perfectly comfortable posture and position? Even if I had a whole range of cushions and could give you unlimited cushions, instead of having sitting on the concrete, you could sit on water beds. If we could have the most comfortable, ergonomically designed meditation cushion in the world, you'd still not be able to sit without some physical discomfort. I like to bring people's attention to the fact that why do you move? Why do you scratch? Why do you fidget? Why do you even blink your eyelids? It's always because of discomfort, suffering. And it's because of the hope to overcome that discomfort. Once I scratch my nose once, I hope it just doesn't itch anymore. But have you ever noticed if you scratch it once, there's always an itch comes somewhere else? And soon the whole body is itchy. If you move one leg, you have to move an arm. If you move an arm, you have to swallow. Whatever it is you find, there's always some problem with the body. And this is why, to understand, you don't overcome or free yourself from sensory desire, from the first hindrance, by following desire. The more you indulge in desire, the more you get hooked into that whole process of trying to find comfort. And you never find comfort. The more you fidget, the more you have to fidget. And there's another way to overcoming sensory desire. Once you understand that it's in debt, then just don't borrow any money, and then you're never in debt. Don't seek for sensory pleasure. But see the danger in, say, scratching when you're meditating. See the danger in moving when you're meditating. See the danger in just looking for some sort of comfort in a place you can't find comfort. When you realize that that is a hindrance to the meditation, trying to find some comfort in the body, you can never find total comfort. I know that one day that somebody in our monastery asked Ajahn Chah if he could sit meditation in chairs because their knees were aching. And he said, look, he said, if I allow you to sit in a chair, then you want a comfy chair, then you want an armchair, then you want a lazy boy, and then you want to sort of meditate on a bed, and every time I give a talk you have to wheel your bed in so you can lay on your bed. And he's actually absolutely true there. No, there's not any bed, you have to get a nice bed, a water bed, a four poster bed. Because the search for sensory comfort doesn't know an ending at all. It goes on and on and on. The only way to end that search for sensory comfort is to let go of the senses. To ignore them. This is why, when in meditation, when there's an itch in the body, there's an ache in the knee, you want to swallow some saliva, just forget about it. Don't even think about it. Turn the attention back to your breath or whatever else you're watching. And you find that only when you ignore the body when you're not trying to satisfy its constant desire for comfort and attention, only then does the body give you peace. When I'm meditating, I try and get in a comfortable position to start with, but I can never get in a comfortable position. There's always some ache, some itch, some pain somewhere in my body. So the only thing I do, I just minimize that and then just forget about the body. I don't try and make it comfortable because I know I will never be able to make it comfortable that way. Instead, I take all my attention away from the body. So you're not even going to play the game of seeking for pleasure, seeking for comfort in this body. You know, it is a hopeless task. It is endless. As soon as you take away your attention from the pleasure, pain, discomforts in the body and put it somewhere else in your meditation object, after a while the body disappears, or rather your perception of the body disappears, and that's the only time you have freedom from the demands of the body. There's no way that giving a talk that I can sit still because I'm just paying too much attention outside. But if I meditate, then you can go inside and sit absolutely still for long periods of time. So I was saying some years ago, taking a video of a monk meditating, and then it was fascinating on the video machine playing it fast forward. Because when you play it fast forward, you actually can see people move very easily. And this was great. This mic, fast forward or normal speed, it looked exactly the same. There's no movement there. That actually showed that the mind was still. And sometimes people say, how can you sit so long without moving? There must be an enormous amount of willpower to keep your body absolutely rigid like that. It's not willpower at all, you've just got to forget about your body. That's the only way you can free yourself from that hindrance of the demands of the five senses for comfort. You follow those demands and they will always give you problems and trouble. You let go of those demands and it disappears. The five hindrances, the five senses are like these five telephones on the desk of your mind. If you answer one telephone, then they know you're in and they won't stop ringing. So don't answer the first phone. You don't answer, they'll keep on ringing at first. And then it goes dead. And they'll ring again. Then they might try another line. But if after a few minutes you don't answer any telephones, you'll find they'll stop ringing. And you'll have some silence for a change. Five telephones, you know, are sound, sight, smell, taste and touch. Especially that touch phone. That is really the noisy one. People love it to ring you up on that one. Never give you any peace. So this is a hindrance to the meditation. We always want to have physical comfort. We want sensory comfort. We're worrying about what we're going to eat. You know that whatever you eat is never going to be satisfying. Even the most delicious food, you put it in your mouth and it's gone too quickly. It's a problem with food. And even it's in this particular meditation retreat, I didn't mention that practice of mindfulness when you're eating. When you're having your lunch today, make sure that you only eat one spoon or one fork at a time. In other words, when you're eating, say, with a fork or with a spoon, you're picking up that piece of food, and before it's gone into your mouth, most people are already thinking what they're going to eat next. So they're looking at what's down in their plate, even before this one's got in the mouth yet. And that's not mindfulness of the present moment. So when you pick up the food, put it in your mouth, taste it and swallow it, and don't think what you're going to eat next. You can eat anything. Just be with that food. Can you see how desire, craving is always three or four steps ahead of yourself? So here you notice you never get delicious food. It may be delicious for a moment and then it's gone. But you've got to swallow it. Or hold it in your mouth for long periods of time. Hold it, when you want to swallow it, just hold it for a bit longer until all the taste is gone. And Ajahn Chah used to say, when all the taste is gone, when it's thoroughly masticated, just take it out and put it on your hand and look at it. And shout to the person sitting next to you as well. That's a delicious food, and ask if they want a bit of it. Would you like to put that back in your mouth again? When all the taste is gone, when it's just this masticated lump of... So that's food. That's food for you. So you can see, you can never get sort of fun in that realm. But what you do get, if you leave alone that realm, just abandon it, don't care about it, just eat for the sake of the body, just to keep health, then you'll find there's a great deal of peace in this world. And a great deal of ease as well. You don't care so much what you eat. You don't care so much what you see. You don't need to go and pay lots and lots of money to go and see these movies, or to go and see these amazing, beautiful scenes of nature, which you've got to trek for so many days and go through these airports and go through customs and all these sorts of things. You don't need to do that. You have a lot more contentment just in simplicity. When you let go of that world of the five senses, then you have a lot of freedom just to be with the world of the mind, knowing that you can never find true happiness in that realm, because it's always so unstable. Whatever little happiness you get disappears so quickly, and you're in debt afterwards. So letting go of that world, see, by seeing its danger, means you know that it's a waste of time trying to look for something beautiful in this retreat center. There'll always be something wrong with the flowers. It's a waste of time looking for beautiful sounds. Even the talks which I give, some are nice, some are not so nice. If I give a really good talk, then the next talk is really disappointing because I can't keep up the standard. So you can never sort of get full satisfaction even with sound. Smell and taste and physical body, you'll never get comfort if you seek for comfort in the body. So the Karmachanda is this whole movement of the mind which is concerned with finding happiness in the realm of the five senses. And that is what drives most people throughout their lives. And even in the meditation session it drives them, trying to find the most comfortable position to sit. Even looking forward to the meals. Even the echoes of that world in thinking, in fantasizing, in dreaming. Dreaming about sensory pleasures, fantasizing and thinking these things, they will never give you happiness. It will just make you more hungry, that's all. It just makes you more suffering, more in debt. So that's why that you see in this meditation retreat, if you want to have peace and freedom, you have to not play around in that world. You have to let go of that world. The Buddha gave another simile. He said it's like a lake which is full of these colours and dyes. Because someone has tipped in these toxins into the water, these paints, polluting the water, you can't see the bottom. You can't get even clarity. All you can see is the colours. Or it's like sort of a person. I give the simile of an emperor. The emperor who's got these very beautiful trousers on and very smart boots and a very brilliant jacket, and it's got a sort of a big hat over the top of his head and a big scarf wrapped around the bottom half of his head. You can't see the emperor because of those five garments: the shoes, the trousers, the jacket, the hat and the scarf. All you can see is just the beautiful clothes, and you think that that's what the emperor is, just the clothes, because you can't see what the real emperor is, the person underneath all of this. And sometimes that we get entranced just by the clothes, by the adornments. We don't really know what's the truth underneath. In this meditation you've got to take the clothes off the emperor and see what is hiding. See what those colours in the water are hiding. See what's the depth of this mind, this being. And so those are the five senses, the clothes. The emperor is the mind itself, and it's bared of all those clothes, you find that whether it's an emperor, whether it's a pauper, whether it's a man or a woman, it's exactly the same being. The mind. Is it just the external clothing we put onto this mind? Man, woman, Asian, European, famous, infamous. This is just the clothing on the mind. This is the realm of the five senses, not the sixth sense. So in this meditation we have to overcome and let go of that concern for the body. Don't answer any of the phones. If you're looking for sensory delight, sensory comfort even, you won't find it. Just leave it alone. Don't play, don't answer the phone. And then you will find a sense of peace. When you're not looking for pleasure, the sight calms down and then stops and is still. When you're not looking for beautiful sounds, then you don't listen at all. When you're not looking for beautiful smells, beautiful tastes, that's not an important part of your life. You can eat anything, it doesn't disturb you. And when you can let go of the body, you're not really concerned about aches and pains or itches or heat and cold. When you're not concerned about that, then you're fine, you're free. If I think that this place is too hot or it's too cool, it's not enough ventilation or it's too much ventilation, as soon as I start worrying like that, it's endless. We'd have to have a vote. Should we have the fans on this morning or should we not have the fans on this morning? And then we get into arguments. And if I give you permission, or if I give you the opportunity to give your view on that, then it gets into conflict. When we know that we just haven't got a say in the matter, we're at peace. So this is how we let go of the first hindrance, by not trying to find pleasure in that world, not even trying to find comfort in that world, but by abandoning that world. And the next of the hindrances is ill will. That ill will can take three forms. Ill will to somebody else, ill will to yourself, or ill will towards a meditation object. Ill will, the Buddha said, is like someone being sick. Because you're crazy when you have ill will. And it's like a sickness, it afflicts you and it stops you having any happiness, any freedom, any peace. When you're angry, you've got business to do with the object of your anger. That's why there's never any calmness or coolness there. You've got to settle some account. The ill will can very easily come to other people. In this monastery, someone else is just being continually shuffling, and when they come to your meditation cushion, they always brush past you, they make this little awful noise, and they cough, and every time they cough, it's just when you're about to get peaceful in your meditation. You know they're doing it on purpose. That's the point, isn't it? We always think that they're doing it on purpose, they've got it in for us, and that's why we get angry at them. Now that ill towards other people is always overcome through loving kindness and through wisdom, knowing that no one in this meditation retreat is even thinking about you, let alone got it in for you. So just leave it alone. Don't worry about the other person sitting next to you. Just your concern is just with this bubble in which you're meditating. And don't extend that bubble out too far so it hits another person's bubble. Your concern is just with your meditation this weekend, or this 9 days. So give other people the benefit of the doubt. And if they do say something or do something which upsets you, stay in the present moment. Just let go of the past. If they called you a dog a few moments ago, that's already disappeared into the cosmos. You've got into your ear and gone out the other ear and gone way off into the cosmos, and it's gone past you, end of business. Just imagine sound that way, but don't keep it inside. Don't sort of cage it, let it go. And so that means any irritation, it's only an irritation for a moment, and it never gives rise to ill will. However, there's another deeper part of ill will, and that's ill will towards yourself, which is a great hindrance to the meditation. Sometimes you get fed up with yourself, sometimes you get really angry at yourself because you slept in this morning, or you ate too much, or you didn't really put enough effort in the meditation. You've been meditating for so many years and you should be doing better. You know you should be doing better. Don't do it again, right? And you get really angry and have ill will towards yourself. If you have anger and ill will towards yourself, ill will means you don't wish yourself well. You don't allow yourself to be happy. You can't permit yourself to be peaceful. Be careful, because that is a very powerful and deep-seated obstacle to everyone's meditation. Why can't I be at peace? Because you don't think you deserve peace. In Western cultures, we have this stupid thing called guilt. If we make a mistake, we want to be punished for it. And sometimes the cruelest thing to do to another person is, in their eyes anyway, to forgive them. Punish me, please, please punish me, do something to me. Because they want to hurt if they've hurt someone else. It's crazy, it's guilt. And it means you're denying yourself happiness. You're denying yourself peace. In this meditation practice, be careful. If you're always coming across an obstacle, the same obstacle in your practice, and you can't get beyond it, you can't get peaceful, ask yourself, do you really want to be peaceful? Do you really want to be happy? And sometimes I tell people to do a little mental experiment or imagination. Just imagine you've got this box. It's with your eyes closed. Imagine you find a shoebox and you've got some gift wrapping paper. And in that shoebox you put the gift of peace. Just imagine what peace is, whatever you imagine it to be, and put it in that shoebox. Put on the lid. With that wrapping paper, this is all in your mind, imagination. In that wrapping paper, wrap that paper around the box. Go through all the process of wrapping, getting some sticky tape and just taping it down. Finding a little ribbon to tie around that box, and a little gift card. And on that gift card, write, "To me, with love, from me." And push that box aside, and imagine that you're playing this game, you're giving yourself a gift. Imagine you forget all about that gift. And then you look at the box again. Oh, it's a present. I wonder who this is for. And have a look at the gift card, and there you see, wow, it's to me, with love, for me. And just like you're opening any present, just open it slowly, carefully. Wonder what's inside. Open up the ribbon, unstick the tape, take off the wrapping paper, and just with all the excitement, as if it's a gift which other people give you, just open the box and see what's inside. Ah, it's peace. Just what I wanted. How did I know? If you do this, what it's actually doing, it's a psychological process. If you just say, just be peaceful, it's not strong enough. You need to go through a ritual, through a ceremony, to give yourself peace. It's psychologically more potent. Instead of peace, you could put forgiveness in that box. Whatever it is which gives you the freedom to let go of ill will towards yourself, which allows you to be happy. Again, a nun some years ago was getting very close to jhanas. And I remember her coming to tell me that she got a beautiful nimitta up, but then she couldn't follow it through. And it really shocked me what she said. She said, "I didn't think I deserved so much happiness." And straight away, just my mind, my heart sank. You just came so close to beautiful experiences. And it just, that ill will towards yourself, that last smidgen of that hindrance, stopped you going right into jhanas and really enjoying yourself and getting enormous wisdom. What a shame. And I told her afterwards, "You do deserve it. Every one of you deserves to bliss out completely, absolutely. Why not? Give yourself that freedom to be happy. But be careful. If ever that comes up, you think you don't deserve so much happiness, so much peace. Check that and say, why not? Who said so? And check out whether it really is ill will towards yourself, which is the obstacle. This is a way to overcome it. Ill will, the Buddha said, is just like the water boiling again, so you can't really see what's at the bottom there. It's just too turbulent. You never find wisdom through ill will. And lastly, you can have ill will towards a meditation object itself. Ill will towards a meditation object means you meditate with force. I'm going to watch this breath. I'm going to conquer this breath. Just like a US Marine going to conquer a foreign troops. You can only never conquer the enemy that way. You just subdue the enemy for a while until it rises up in rebellion. You've got to win the hearts of the people. You've got to win the heart of the breath, if that's what you're doing. That's why to overcome that ill will towards the meditation object, which is another reason why people can't find peace in their meditation, to use different analogies. Look upon the breath as your best friend. And instead of trying to hold and crush the breath, imagine yourself holding the hand of your breath or walking together down the road. Just holding the hand like a good friend. So mindfulness is holding the hand of the breath. Not clenched tightly, but just gently, because you're enjoying each other's company. That's going against the ill will of trying to conquer the breath, trying to throttle the breath, trying to sort of put shackles around the breath. Just gently hold its hand. That way there's a sense of fun and joy with the breath. The other way is always making sure that when you're breathing in a delightful breath. So it is something which engenders, not ill will, but engenders like loving kindness, care, happiness. That's why, to get into deep meditation, make sure when you're breathing in a beautiful breath. One of the great monks in Thailand at the moment has been here, Ajahn Gunha. His meditation method was just to breathe in this Thai word, sabai. Make the most delicious, peaceful breath you can possibly make. Breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. Oh, that sounds really good. If you can do that, it's so easy to watch the breath, because you love to watch the breath, you want to watch the breath. You're not watching the breath with ill will, you're watching it with loving kindness, with gentleness, with care. Same way that if you have a baby, if it's some little brat, you're really sort of sending you up the wall, you've got lots of ill will towards it, you love someone to take it off your hands for a while. If you have ill will towards the breath, someone will take it off your hands for a while and you'll lose it. But if it's your baby, it's such a beautiful baby, and you're cooing and loving it and caring for it, if it was your very baby, which you love so much, would you ever drop it on the way to the shops and wonder, where did I drop that? Where's it gone? I had the baby a few moments ago, but it's gone now. That's what happens in meditation. You've got the breath. It's gone, where's it gone? Where's my leaving? You wouldn't sort of go to the shops and leave it on the counter, would you? Because it's someone you love and care for, you carry it around with you, and you're always checking to make sure it's okay. If you have ill will towards the breath, that's why it gets lost so easy. You just don't care about it. If you have loving kindness towards the breath, real loving kindness and care, it's easy to keep your attention on it. You just love being with the breath. Find with a really good friend, someone I've spent so much happy moments with. Just love being with them. It's no effort at all. If it's someone, you know, who wants to go and talk to me about their problems, and I'm just really tired, I don't really want to be with them, but I'm a monk, I suppose I should be with them. you're quite happy when they go away. Quicker the better, perhaps, I must admit. But sometimes, if it's with a really good friend, you just like to be in their company, and they stay a long time, because you want them to stay a long time. That's why the breath can stay a long time. You have loving kindness towards it. You haven't got ill will towards a meditation object. Check that one out. See if that's your problem in the meditation. You don't really want to be with that object. You don't like being with that object. No wonder it doesn't stay. So ill will towards a meditation object is one of the biggest hindrances. This is why I always say, just make it lovely, make it beautiful, make it wonderful. And then you can stay with the breath for as long as you like. It's so wonderful, so beautiful. Third of the hindrances is sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, which I'm sure you've all come across during this meditation retreat, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning. But sometimes it's just natural because you're tired. But sometimes it's not natural at all, it's just laziness, the slackness of the mind. So overcome that sloth and torpor, just remember how much you paid to come here. Don't waste your money. Also, remember that sloth and torpor, the way I used to really be very stuck in sloth and torpor, and I used to be one of the great nodders in the monastery in Thailand. You know what it's like sometimes when you start sitting, it's like nodding and nodding and nodding more and more, and sometimes you see monks, it's nodding more and more. Naturally, I used to be one of the great ones of that. But I was very relieved when I started reading these books, the suttas, to find one of the greatest nodders in the time of the Buddha was Venerable Mahamoggallana, one of the two chief disciples. And the Buddha found him nodding one day and said, "Moggallana, you're nodding." He said, "Ah, yes." But soon well afterwards he became one of the greatest meditators with enormous psychic powers. And then in another sutta I read about the Buddha going with Ananda and saw a monk at the edge of the forest sitting dead straight in meditation, and the Buddha saw him and said to Ananda, "I'm worried about that monk. I don't think he's going to last very long." And sure enough, a few weeks later he disrobed. He was just too close to the sensory delights of the village. But later on he went right in the depth of the forest. We saw another monk there, living in such simplicity and frugality, but he was nodding all over the place, he was meditating. And the Buddha smiled and said, "I'm not worried about that monk at all. He'll soon sort of overcome that defilement and become an arahant." And so he did. And that gave me a lot of confidence when I was nodding. Because it's just something we go through in our meditation. The reason why we have that sloth and torpor is the two parts of the mind, the doer and the knower. When we are calming the mind, if we don't know the difference, clearly know the difference between the doer and the knower, we tend to calm both at the same time. Sure, we stop doing things, we get very calm, but we also calm the knower, so we're not really aware that we are calm. We get into dullness. But the way the Buddha said, this is at least you're calming the doer down. That's the hard thing. It's not that hard afterwards just to keep the knower bright as you're calming the doer. Just separate the two of them. Just calm the doing and keep the knowing bright. And that is what one has to do. So to overcome that sloth and torpor, see if you can perceive and get to understand the difference between the doer and the knower. And when you're meditating, keep the knower bright, but calm the doer down. One way to keep the knower bright, again, is to bring joy into your meditation. Just enjoy what you're doing. This is one of the practices which I teach at the monastery at Serpentine. Develop the perception of beauty in the simple. Look at the carpet. I've been walking up and down on this carpet. It's not a particularly expensive carpet, but see if you can see something beautiful in that carpet. Once you can start seeing something beautiful in the carpet, it catches your attention. You're not bored with it anymore. You can't get dull. With whatever meditation object you're on, if you can see something beautiful, interesting in what you're doing, you'll never get dull. Sleepiness and tiredness won't come. This is why you have to brighten the mind. to brighten the mind if you're watching the breath. Just see which is the longer, the in-breath or the out-breath. Just see just how the breath gets in. See if there's a gap between the breaths. Make it interesting. Make it fascinating. Those of you who've done counting the breaths, breathing in one, breathing out one, breathing in two, breathing out two. Make it interesting. Breathe upside down. Breathe out one, then breathe in one. Breathe out two, breathe in three. Just something simple like that will change. Just do it differently. Make it more fascinating. The other way which you can overcome that hindrance of sloth and torpor is to use what I call the simile of the snake. Because when I was in the monastery in Thailand as a young monk, it was a jungle monastery in those days. There were snakes and scorpions and goodness knows what else who all regarded you as their dinner. And the paths were just paths which were swept through the jungle, and it was such a poor monastery at that time that very often you didn't even have any flashlight batteries. You just couldn't see. You had to use the light of the moon or the light of the stars shining through the canopy of the jungle. And there were snakes about. And you used to meditate until late at night, had to go back to your hut knowing there were snakes around. Now of course, if you step on one of those snakes, that's it. They bite you and you're dead. So I was very aware on the way back from the meeting of the evening. And even without a flashlight, I was on the lookout for snakes. I knew they were around and they were dangerous, so I was very alert. I wasn't just whistling and thinking about something else. I was just looking at the path intently. And if I saw a dark shape over the path, I'd stop and investigate to make sure it wasn't a snake. It could be just a stick, you never know. If it was a snake, because I saw it in time, I'd always escape from injury. This is the simile of the snake. If you know, say, that sloth and torpor is your hindrance, is your problem, is your difficulty, regard it as a snake who's out there on the path of meditation to strangle you or to bite you and create pain. When you know that this is a common obstacle for you, be wary of it. Look out for it. And then what happens is you see that hindrance or these other hindrances before they've got a chance to really put their coils around you. Sloth and torpor is like a python. Because once it's got its first coils around you and you start getting dark, it's just hard, almost impossible, to unwind that sloth and torpor from around the mind. It's got you. And sometimes all you can do is just go and have a rest. Or go and do something else. You can start trying to use willpower when you're sloth and torpor, trying to break through it, but it's almost impossible. The python's already got you. But if you see that python when it's just coming towards you, then you can take evasive action. You start to see yourself getting slothful. You start to see the signs coming. That's the time to act. To avoid the snake when it's still at a distance. By looking at it as a snake, as a danger, you find you can avoid it. You actually start to see sloth and torpor happening. If I follow that path, I'm going to really get into slothfulness. You know the Buddha's simile about sloth and torpor? He said it's like being in a prison. It's like being a prisoner. Because you just can't move. You're stuck in a very cramped and dark cell. That's what it's like when you're dull. You just can't live out there and you're imprisoned. You can't enjoy anything. Or he said it's just like a body of water with algae on the surface. It's not moving. So again, you can't see. It's polluting the mind, polluting the water. So try and overcome that hindrance just by avoiding it in plenty of time. Having joy in the mind. The next hindrance is restlessness and remorse. The remorse sometimes called worry. It is really remorse. It's when you've made a mistake in your precepts, when you haven't kept the rules, when you feel guilty about it afterwards. Whenever you do bad karma, there's always a response. And much of that response is remorse. And that again stops you feeling happy, stops you feeling at peace. The only real way to overcome that is not to make any mistakes in the first place. If you do make a mistake, ask forgiveness. Go up to the person you've offended. Or, if it's in a retreat, go up to the Buddha and ask forgiveness. Just bow and say, look, I made a mistake. But I shouldn't have done that. I was talking to my friend and that's breaking the ninth precept here. I ask forgiveness. I'll try not to do it again. And that will free the mind from that hindrance. The restlessness is when you're always looking for something else to do. You're never happy with where you are. The opposite of restlessness is contentment. And this is such an important quality to develop in this meditation retreat. To develop that appreciation of the happiness and the pleasure, the beauty in this moment. So that you have no restlessness at all. Restlessness comes from what I keep calling the fault-finding mind. In this moment, you can always find fault with it. There's always something wrong. Even in a retreat center, there's always something wrong. With the food, there's always something wrong. I remember the IMS in Massachusetts, this really five-star meditation center. They put so much money into building this meditation center in Massachusetts that one day they decided to see if they can make it better by putting up a suggestions box. And they were just amazed, just having tried so hard to give a menu with what food you want, to give really nice beds, every room an ensuite, just so nice and so wonderful. They found the more comfortable they made it, the more complaints they got. When they had retreats in rough old centres, they didn't get hardly any complaints. And it was really interesting. The closer you get to perfection, the more it irritates you when you're just that little bit distance from perfection. It's a fault-finding mind. This is why that fault-finding mind gives rise to restlessness. You can't sit still because it's not good enough here. It might be good somewhere else. And you're always on the move. Even in your mind. Instead of just being content, just being with the present moment, I want to get on to the silence of the mind. I want to get on to the breath. I want to get on to nimittas. I really want to get into jhanas. Come on. That's restlessness. You'll never get into jhanas with restlessness. Stay where you are. Be content with what you've got. And you'll find instead of looking for jhanas over there, you'll find them right here in the moment. This is why I gave the other day the simile of the lotus opening. The next stage of the meditation is within the stage you're experiencing now. If you can only have full contentment with this stage of the meditation, full contentment with where you are, then the lotus opens up all by itself and it reveals the next stage. You don't have to move on to the next stage. You don't move on to the next stage. You move in to the next stage. Do you understand the difference? Don't move on to the next stage. Move in to the next stage. Inside the present moment, you'll find the silence. Inside the silence, you'll find the breath. Inside the breath, you'll find the beautiful breath. Inside the beautiful breath, you'll find a nimitta. And inside the nimitta, you'll find the jhanas. You don't give up the nimitta, you just go right inside of it. You don't give up the breath, you just go right into the center of the breath. It's where the nimitta is. You go in, not on. If you go on, it means you're sort of giving up what you've got now for something else. That's restlessness, that's craving, that's desire. If you're going in, it just shows deeper and deeper contentment. Imagine you're sitting in a comfortable chair and you're just so comfortable you just don't want to go anywhere else. That's called contentment. Contentment gives rise to stillness, not moving. not moving gives rise to peace, gives rise to intense peace, gives rise to blissful peace. So don't move. Restlessness, the Buddha said, is like being a slave. It's a beautiful simile. Sometimes the similes of the Buddha you can think about, contemplate for years and years and years and still sort of be so impressed at the choice of simile. You're a slave, always being told, go here, go there, come on, get me a cup of tea, that's not the right tea, get me another cup of tea, never giving a moment's rest. That's what a slave is like, always at the beck and call of craving. Free yourself from slavery by freeing yourself from restlessness, especially the restlessness which manifests as this thinking mind. The thinking mind I call the tyrant, always telling you what to do, telling you how hopeless you are, telling you you should be doing better, telling you that if you do it this way it'll probably work this time. Always lies, isn't it? Don't believe that thinking mind, that tyrant, that's restlessness. That is always pushing you around. Just say, shut up, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. If you say that to your boss, the boss inside, the tyrant, you're not a slave anymore. Don't be a slave to your thinking mind. Don't be a slave to restlessness. In the water simile, the Buddha said that restlessness is this water whipped up by waves, this way and that. Again, you can't see deeply into it because the surface is disturbed. The last of the hindrances is doubt. Doubt can take many forms. Doubt as to the teacher, doubt the teaching, but the most insidious form of doubt is doubt into your own ability. Hopefully that doubt into the teachings, that's my job to try and overcome that doubt by explaining them very carefully to you. And also, every time you meditate, always find out what's happened afterwards. Spend a few minutes at the end of the meditation just becoming aware of how you feel. If you can do that, you'll notice that every meditation you get some degree of peace. And that will overcome the doubt that this is something which actually works. You do get peaceful in this meditation. You can do it. It also overcomes the doubt in your own ability. Sometimes people come up to me and say, you know, why do you teach jhana to us? We're only lay people. Surely, I mean, no, we can't get jhanas, it's just beyond me. Or maybe someone else can do, but not me. If you think you can't, you won't. Never have that doubt. As far as Buddhism, the teachings are concerned, the Buddha said the only people who cannot get jhanas or cannot get enlightened in this lifetime are people who have killed their mother or killed their father, created a schism in the Sangha, drawn the blood of a Buddha, or I think raped a bhikkhuni. That's all. So if you've done one of those, then okay, you can't get jhanas. But if you haven't done any of those, then you can. So there's no room for doubt then. Oh, I'm hopeless, I can't do this. If you say you can't, then of course you've closed the door. It's my job to encourage you. Yes, you can. If you were playing a tennis match and your coach said, you know, you're playing a champion today, you've got no chance in the world of beating him, what sort of coach would that be? Even the coach sometimes has to grit his teeth and sort of almost lie and say, yeah, you can beat this champion. This is a champion, but you know, he's past his prime now. And he's feeling bad. I just saw him in training because he's really hopeless. But you can really, and you're always sort of up and coming. You can do this. You can win. Come on, yeah. Because if the coach really encourages you, it's amazing what you can do. You find you can win because you believe in yourself. You believe in your own ability. You've got no doubt it can be done. If you have no doubt it can be done, it is done. And you surprise yourself. It's amazing just in a retreat like this how much you can surprise yourself. Sometimes people have never meditated before, because they got some confidence and belief. They're not hindered by their past failures. They can do marvelously well. Never think you can't. And when monks come up to me and say, I can't get these jhanas, I say, hang on, can't yet. Always we use the word YET, not yet. It's only a matter of time. So this is overcoming that doubt. The doubt is doubt in yourself, doubt is the teaching, doubt in the teacher. Sometimes the Buddha says it's like being lost in the desert. Make sure you have a very clear method so you know all the landmarks. Again, that's my job, to make sure you know where you are in this meditation, to know the landmarks and know where to go next. And to have confidence that other people have crossed that desert. It's not that dangerous. You can also. Whenever you come across a problem in the meditation, look at those five hindrances. See if you can find which one is it, or which one is the most prominent. If you've got an obstacle, is it sensory desire? Is it ill will? Is it sloth and torpor? Is it restlessness? Remorse? Is it doubt? Find out which one it is. I usually find it's a combination, but there'll always be one which is prominent. Find out which one it is. Once you've diagnosed the problem, then apply the remedy. Then you become a very skillful meditator. A meditator who knows the five hindrances, but most importantly, knows how to overcome them. When those five hindrances are known, you know how to overcome them, then there is nothing between you and the jhanas. No obstacles, just a very clear path, a clear road, with no traffic lights to stop you. So those are the five hindrances and their importance in the practice. Is there any question about that before we finish? The other two, it's only mentioned in this sutta, it's weariness and discontent. The weariness is almost like part of sloth and torpor. You'll find that if you keep on plugging away at meditation, after a while you do get sort of tired and sort of you don't sort of feel like you want to put the energy anymore. You get dispirited. But if you get a deep meditation, just one meditation, and you're bright and cheery and you've got all the energy in the world, you just can't wait to get back and meditate some more. And all the heaviness of the body disappears. You know how it is sometimes in the mornings or in the afternoons, the body feels just such a heavy weight. You can hardly sort of keep it up, and you can't hardly even drag it to lunch. But when you have a deep meditation, a good meditation, all that heaviness disappears and just light, you're floating. Life becomes effortless. That's the sort of heaviness of that weariness. When the five hindrances are there, they just, like a ball and chain, they just make life just so hard, you're dragging yourself through the day. Good meditation, just bright and skipping around, floating on air, for sometimes days. And the other one is the discontent. So when those five hindrances are there, they always have this fault finding, not really content here, the food's not good enough, the people in this retreat aren't good enough, the teaching's not good enough. You know, the mat is not good enough, the bed's not good enough, even the birds here, they don't chant good enough. You get some different birds here instead of those crows. Whatever it is, you get to that discontent mind, you've got no happiness and everything stinks, including yourself. And that discontent is so easy to get into. And that's when the five hindrances are there, they stop you seeing the beauty. And this is one thing which happens in meditation, it's happened to me so often. Once you get your meditation really going, just this whole retreat center starts to shine and glisten. Even the bricks on the wall are just so beautiful. And the flowers on the trees, wow, they're amazing. It's like, you know, when people in the 60s going on drugs, it blows your mind. This is without any drugs, just outside, the whole universe just opens in beauty to you when you've got this powerful mind free from the hindrances. Just everything is shiny and brilliant and bright. Just like you've had a windscreen on your car and it's just been full of dirt and grime and splattered insects. And then you clean it all off and you can see clearly and everything is just so brilliant and shiny and clear. That's what happens when hindrances go. So you don't have discontent, but everything is just so full of contentment. You go around with a nice smile on your face. That's how I can tell if people got the meditation. See if they're smiling. Okay, thank you for that question. If there's any more questions, please put them on a piece of paper and ask them later on this evening. That's a talk on the five hindrances. A nice method for overcoming the obstacles.